I was 8 years old when I first found the magazine, sitting on the dusty wooden floor of a used bookstore. My father was a book designer who enjoyed the company of ancient volumes, and he often took me on book hunting expeditions around New York, leaving me with a pile of vintage magazines while he went off to prowl among the dark and crowded shelves. That day I picked up a tattered old issue of Gourmet, enchanted by the cover drawing of a majestic swordfish leaping joyfully from the water. This looked nothing like the ladies' magazines my mother favored, with their recipes for turkey divan made with cans of mushroom soup, or pot roast topped with ketchup. And I opened it to find the pages filled with tales of food in faraway places. A story called Night of Lobster caught my eye. And as I began to read, the walls faded, the shop around me vanishing until I was sprawled on the sands of a small island off the coast of Maine. The tide was coming in, water tickling my feet as it crept across the beach. It was a deep night, the sky like velvet, spangled with stars. Much later, I understood how lucky I was to have stumbled on that story. The author, Robert P. Tristram Coffin, was the poet laureate of Maine and a Pulitzer Prize winner with such an extraordinary gift for words that I could hear the hiss of a giant kettle and feel the bonfire burning as the flames leapt into the night. The fine, spicy fragrance of lobster was so real to me that I reached for one, imagined tossing it from hand to hand until the shell was cool enough to crack. The meat was tender, briny, rich. Somewhere off in the distance, a fish splashed, then swam silently away. I closed the magazine and the real world came into focus. I was a little girl leafing through the pages of a magazine printed long before I was born, but I kept turning the pages, enchanted by the writing, devouring tales of long-lost banquets in Tibet, life in Paris, and golden fruit growing on strange tropical trees. I had always been an avid reader, but this was different. This was not a made-up story. It was about real life. From the opening pages of Save Me the Plums, my gourmet memoir by Ruth Riekel. You read those opening lines, and whether we're 18 or 85, we have all had those special memories of childhood. Moments of nostalgia when we're swept back to a happier time, a moment, a week, when something special happened to us. And so it is with the first pages, the first chapter of Save Me the Plums, a delightfully written and engaging memoir, as I hope you heard, by food critic and novelist Ruth Riekel, one of whose earliest treasured memories is that first encounter with Gourmet magazine that we just heard. Save Me the Plums is a memoir filled with delightful ups and sadly remembered downs. Albeit with more of the positive than the negative. Still, early on we read that Riekel is disappointed in the treasured magazine of her youth, that Gourmet with the leaping fish on the cover, finds her unacceptable as a writer soon after she graduates from college. And the opening chapter ends with a bittersweet swipe, so real to any of us who've been deeply disappointed by a love in our youth. As she writes, the editor at Gourmet remained unmoved. "Thank you for taking the time to visit," she said. "I had been dismissed." Utterly crushed, I left the office. Other magazines proved more enthusiastic, and I sold enough stories to be able to spend a month in Thailand, pursuing unfamiliar flavors in the far corners of the country. I wished the articles were for Gourmet, but now when I picked up the magazine, I saw that the adventurous spirit that had thrilled me as a child was gone. We had grown apart. I belonged to the rock and roll generation, thrilled by the changes in the American way of eating. Gourmet was a stately grande dame, looking admiringly across the ocean and wistfully back to the past. The recipes were still reliable, but the tone had changed. Instead of stories about men rowing out for midnight lobster raids, there were prissy pieces about pricey restaurants and fancy resorts. I moved on to younger magazines, and although I continued to follow a few favorite writers, for the next 25 years, I rarely gave the magazine a thought. Gourmet magazine was, for a long time, one of our nation's most exquisite, most appreciated magazines, opening its pages and its readers to the best of food, of culture, of the world of good food and good writing. It was the doorway through which Riekel learned the richness of cooking, after all. But by the time Condé Nast Publications, the folks who put out Gourmet, reached out to her to become its editor, to shake up what had become a stodgy print magazine in the later 1990s, Riekel was not at all sure she was up to the task. She was a food writer, she told herself. What did she know of managing a full-blown magazine in New York City? And so, this is the story of the moment restaurants became an important part of popular culture. At a time when the rise of the farm-to-table movement changed the way we eat. And we learn quite early in this memoir that Riekel had to convince herself that she was up to the task of heading up Gourmet magazine, this former self-styled Berkeley, California hippie, this food writer who had amassed a huge following first on the West Coast and on the East Coast at the New York Times, could not see the management of Gourmet as a position that more than one of her friends, and certainly her would-be employers, saw her doing with aplomb. With a resume that clearly pointed to such a sparkling and creative-filled future, Riekel walks us through her deep reluctance to take on Gourmet's leadership. Yes, she was a well-regarded restaurant critic at the New York Times, for heaven's sake. And yes, she had headed up a popular food section for the Los Angeles Times newspaper, but still, she agonized over the Condé Nast Corporation's offer to head one of the two food magazines of the 20th century, the other, of course, being Bon Appetit. And this was a leadership offer made by no less than the editorial director of Condé Nast, and ultimately by billionaire investor Cy Newhouse. So yes, we can say Riekel was a difficult get for the magazine, and she credits her own inner resolve to leap beyond her fear of change and her self-doubts through her deep appreciation of the advice offered her by three older women, well-regarded in their literary careers and mentors to Riekel throughout her already successful years of journalism. They encouraged her to throw her cautionary sense to the wind and take on this journalistic enterprise. Heck yes, who else is going to manage Gourmet magazine if not you, they seem to say. And so, once she says yes, she throws her considerable vision, her enthusiasm, into Gourmet's turnaround. She is candid about the world of opulence, riches that she is invited into by the Condé Nast folks. And she is quite open about how easily she found fitting into a world where a chauffeured car, a generous wardrobe allowance, stays in none but the best hotels, and of course, the best in restaurant dining, became a natural part of her daily life. A daily business life, that is, because it was outside of her home that the Condé Nast influence became so critical to her and to her endeavors. She continues to run her home with her longtime husband, Michael, and their son, Nick. Her staff at Gourmet she finds creative, generous, committed to making the best gourmet magazine they can produce, even if it does mean that Riekel has to shake up what had become a stodgy magazine stuck in once glory days by pursuing what some staff sometimes saw as risky, even over-the-top forays into cookery, photography, and storytelling with food. And that storytelling was, by all accounts, her account in particular, incredible. Here's just a moment when she tells us about one of those food creations she stumbled upon when she wandered into the gourmet kitchens one day. I could feel their eyes open upon me as I studied the jewel-like little cake, considering my options. I could begin by commenting on the praline topping. Was it too sweet, too bitter, perhaps too burnt? Maybe the pieces should be smaller. The chocolate was another obvious target. I'd suggest using one of the higher quality. Should I speak up for the marcapone? Then the fork met my mouth. And my body was flooded with sensations as the dark, dense, near bitterness of the cake collided with the crackling sweetness of the praline. The flavors tumbled about, a sensory circus that was finally tamed by the rich smoothness of the frosting. It was all I could do to keep from reaching for a second bite. Extremely hard to hide my smile. I know this cake. The cook's eyes bored into me. I'm guessing, I tried to sound tentative, that this cake has an English pedigree. How did you know? Amy's voice rose in surprise. Zane did a little double take. Unlike Americans, I went on, the English don't overdo the sugar in their chocolate cakes. The cooks gazed at me with obvious respect, and Zane nodded sagely. That praline's a nice touch, I continued. Lovely texture. And I wouldn't mess with the marcapone. Cream cheese reads so carrot cake, don't you think? But it's only a yaffy, objected Kempe. I ignored the interruption. And I do think you should try better chocolate. Schaffenberger? Again, Zane looked impressed. The high-end chocolate was new to the market, and she had not expected me to know it. I was, after all, a critic, not a cook. It's excellent chocolate, and I find it really makes a difference in baking. And it seems to me that the cake might benefit from more eggs. I looked at Amy. Give it more body and improve the crumb. She goes on and on for several more pages, and the mouth just waters ever more. And she concludes this chapter in Save Me the Plums with one of four recipes you'll find scattered throughout the book. This one, jeweled chocolate cake. Haven't made it myself, but I must say, it sounds just incredibly delicious. Riekel's tenure at Gourmet Magazine was a glorious return to the heady days of Gourmet Magazine as a magazine that had so enthralled her as a youth. A Gourmet Magazine that found, she tells us, many new readers while keeping most of the old readers. But spoiler alert, in the end, of course, it was all to come to a crashing end. The same Cy Newhouse who had opened the doors of luxury and creativity to Riekel pulled the plug on the magazines. One day in the late 2000s, I'll not read Riekel's memories of that auspicious afternoon in her New York City office, but it is well worth your time if you read nothing other than the opening chapter and the last. They are full of our author's palpable excitement and luminous writing at its best. I do want to finish with a brief reading from the epilogue. Gourmet Magazine had finished, had quit, had ended. She's trying to move on with her life. Obviously she has, but at this point she's still kind of vague and not sure what's going to happen. And she tells us, finally, haltingly, I began to write again. I was sitting at my computer, lost in a made-up world, when Julio called to say his mother had passed away. Wanted to bequeath me her treasure trove of old gourmet magazines. Did I want them? I hesitated. The issues from my own gourmet years stared down from the bookshelf, but I could hardly bear to look at them. Still, it was a sweet and generous offer, and I could not figure out how to turn him down. I'd love your mother's magazines, I told him. I did not add that they were headed straight for the basement. But when the postman rang the bell, I couldn't fight the urge to peek into the boxes, just to see what they contained. The topmost issue sported a fine old Henry Stalhut drawing on the cover. I remembered this romantic cake, and it gave me a warm feeling, like encountering an old friend after a long time apart. I pulled out the next issue, and the next, unable to resist the lure of those old drawings. Hours passed, and still I sat there, magazines piling up around me. Suddenly, there was the Leaping Swordfish. It was a very ancient issue, 1946. But even after all this time, the fish had the vibrant panache that had called to me so long ago. Almost unconsciously, I opened the magazine to Night of Lobster and find myself once again on a midnight island off the coast of Maine, the sky above me bright with stars. Once again, I smelled the ocean brine, the seaweed, felt damp sand beneath my feet. And I remembered as I read, just how it felt to be 8 years old and setting off on a great adventure. I reached for the next issue. Stalhut had drawn something called chicken paella, a ridiculously old-fashioned concoction surrounded by fussy little artichoke hearts stuffed with olives. But when I opened the magazine, I was reminded of all the reasons I first treasured gourmet. In September 1960, most Americans were happily sitting down to sturdy meals of meatloaf with mashed potatoes. But those early issues offered an alternative foodscape. Here were recipes for Indian dal, lasagna, homemade pasta, mushrooms filled with snails and piñatas, Viennese boiled beef, even home-brewed vinegar. It was an international cornucopia, and I thought proudly that the magazine had truly been a pioneer. Then I turned another page and found myself staring at a recipe for German apple pancakes. It had been years since I'd tasted this particular dish, but the memory was so sharply etched that I could literally taste it. Working from memory, I began breaking eggs into a bowl. The batter should be thin. As the scent of the melting butter filled the kitchen, Nick's partner, Monica, wordlessly began to peel more apples. Michael poured himself a glass of wine. Outside, the sun began to set, filling the sky with a blaze of pink and orange. Sam Cook was singing as I heated up the skillet. We stood there, shimmying around the stove, waiting to see what would happen. Sometimes you know when the very first bite, when a recipe is right. When I slid that floppy crepe out of the skillet, it looked exactly like the one my mother used to love. I sprinkled it with sugar, rolled it up, heated rum, and struck a match. The flames leapt up, and as they died, I wished for just a moment that my parents could be with us. They'd encouraged me to follow my passion, even though it was one they did not share. It's been a long and very satisfying journey. I hope they know that. And of course, the book ends with that recipe for German apple pancake. What a read. What a memoir. Save Me the Plums, my gourmet memoir by Ruth Riekel. It's available at all of our fine local libraries, hopefully soon in your home as well. So come on by the West Lafayette Public Library and pick up a copy. You're going to enjoy Save Me the Plums. It's a great read.